This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Tiara Vian, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. Thanks for listening to this week's podcast. For the week of September 24th, here are some top stories.
Remember when the Trump administration announced a $12 billion aid package for farmers to help with the effects of the trade war? About a tenth of that money will go to buying crops that people in China are not buying. But the food needs a place to go. As Brett Jaspers reports from the KJZZ Business Desk, food banks across the country are getting a welcome but sudden donation.
Dave Richens runs the United Food Bank based in Mesa. They distribute about 20 million pounds of food each year to a five-county area. Fresh produce, frozen chicken, bread from a national bakery.
We get a tremendous amount of bread from Bimbo Bakeries. We get all of their overbake and bake. We get all of Bimbo Bakeries overbake.
Which place?
Bimbo Bakeries.
Richens' walk-in freezer and coolers have a lot of space right now. But this fall, they'll be chock full as part of the program to help American farmers who lost foreign buyers due to retaliatory tariffs. The U.S. Department of Agriculture is buying a lot of food, over $1 billion worth, and sending it out to food banks and other nutrition programs around the country.
So we'll get lots of chicken, lots of pork. We'll get lots of fluid milk. It's cold. Let's get out of here.
Richens is the first to say this is a great thing for the 40 million Americans dealing with food insecurity. But that doesn't mean it'll be easy. The first of four phases will increase his annual distribution by 20%. That requires money for trucks, drivers, fuel, and storage. Richens is seeking $350,000 in new donations.
Some of the food banks are worried that they might not be able to accept all of the food that might come their way because they can't afford to pay additional truck drivers, lease the trucks.
Carrie Calvert is with Feeding America, a national network of food banks. The organization estimates distribution will cost food banks $300 million in all. So Feeding America is trying to help member food banks find the money. Greg Ibaugh is undersecretary for marketing and regulatory programs at the USDA. He says there's some money the department can use, but calls this an opportunity for public-private partnerships.
And we don't anticipate asking Congress for any funds to be able to accomplish our goals.
As for how long this might last, Ibaugh is confident it will be a one-time deal, and the Trump administration will work out these trade issues.
We're hoping that by this time next year, when the 2019 crop is being harvested, that we won't need to talk about any additional assistance program.
But even if this program is one and done, there is a long-term effect for food banks. Calvert says they'll have to figure out how to keep the food flowing even after the bonus program goes away.
We will be able to distribute more food to people in need through this program, and that is a positive thing. However, when this additional food goes away, we don't want to tell the additional families that we've been serving, sorry, the trade mitigation food went away, we can't help you now. We will need to actively look for ways to replace the food so that we can continue serving families in need.
Meanwhile, Dave Richens of United Food Bank seems to handle it all with a chuckle.
Doesn't really sound like you're too worried about this.
No, we're really worried about it. Are you kidding? This is going to be a lot of work. And the first month or two might be a little rocky, but I think we're up to the challenge. I think we're going to be able to get this out.
He's already received the first shipment of bonus ham and pulled pork. Brett Jaspers, KJZZ News, Mesa.
From the Fronteras Desk.
An Arizona-based drywall company faced with an ongoing worker shortage is turning away from foreign guest labor. Now it wants to build a U.S. workforce by investing in a relocation program. In the second part of a Fronteras Desk special report on labor and migration, KJZZ's Matthew Casey spent a morning finding out what it takes to do a job that experts say many Americans won't do.
It's loud and hot on the second floor of what will one day be Homes for Seniors in Goodyear. I'm here learning to hang drywall, which requires hand tools and a piece of metal called a kicker. Think of it like a miniature seesaw with a roller for a pivot point. Once a piece of drywall is lined up vertically, you kick the end of the miniature seesaw underneath it. Then step on the opposite side and use your weight to lift the board into place. Always remember to hold the drywall in place while you put in screws. The company spokeswoman keeps an eye on me while a foreman gives advice.
You always want to put your drill on your tool belt, okay? So that when you're ready to tack it on, it's right there. Whoa. Come on, no accidents.
I made a huge blunder after less than 20 minutes of doing entry-level construction work, and the consequence narrowly missed me. With its new relocation program, Paul Johnson Drywall hopes to attract a mix of workers who are skilled and unskilled, like me.
The genesis of that was Puerto Rico.
Owner Cole Johnson looked to the island after his company was denied foreign guest workers for the first time in years. But he ran into snags when prospects couldn't make it to Arizona and lacked experience drywalling.
And that really is what prompted us to broaden our outreach to the entire continental U.S.
The company prefers candidates with 3 years' experience. They'll be guaranteed 40 hours a week, money to help move and pay rent, health care, and, quote, higher than average wages, end quote. Paul Johnson Drywall will also take unskilled workers, depending on its ability to train them.
The range on the low end would be in that $12 to $13 an hour range for an entry-level labor position,
which adds up to a maximum of $27,000 a year.
These are jobs that Americans have been moving out of quickly because, as I said, the wage is not very high.
Giovanni Perry chairs the economics department at the University of California, Davis. He says construction, agricultural, and service-based companies relied for years on undocumented people for unskilled labor. After 9/11, the national dialogue shifted away from the economics of immigration.
And the debate is mostly about how undocumented are costly, are a danger.
Lost in that, Perry says, is the reality of a domino effect from companies not having enough low-skilled workers.
If you have a construction company that hire fewer of these people, you will have them also hiring fewer engineers, supervisors, electricians, accountants.
You're getting the hang of it, Matt.
I'm really slow.
Not rushing, I decided, was the best way to avoid an injury like the one I escaped. My colleagues work circles around me, and it's clear that it would take years to learn the trade and earn more than $100,000 a year like the top people. The best drywallers can hang an entire room in about a day and a half. I do a few boards, and the guys even show me how to put one on the ceiling. But the heat, the weight of the drywall, and 15 pounds of tools on my belt are draining. I tell my chaperone I've had enough.
I thought I could do a couple hours. I don't think I can.
You're done.
I think I don't want to hurt them or hurt myself.
Paul Johnson Drywall hopes its relocation program will eventually bring in about 100 workers a month. It's taken a little while to iron out the details of the plan. The company says it has been getting calls from prospects, and as of this week, a handful of people have agreed to come work in the Southwest. Matthew Casey, KJZZ News, reporting from Goodyear.
This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening. Now from KJZZ's original production, The Show, here are co-hosts Lauren Gilger and Mark Brody.
Last night, Republican Governor Doug Ducey and Democratic challenger David Garcia met for the second time in 2 nights for a debate. The hour-long debate in Tucson included some heated exchanges between the candidates.
And by the way, I find it interesting that a man who has never worn the uniform is prancing in front of those who do, because he may not understand that it's simpler. It's as simple as this. You do your job.
Lorraine,
Governor,
I've got to address that.
I'm counting six. David,
I honor your service, and I thank you for it. I'm proud of my background as a business person. I think it's important that our viewers know that you hire people into your campaign that post on social media, F Arizona. It seems to me that you have a real issue with law enforcement.
All right, I want to give Mr.
Lorraine,
Garcia 30 seconds for a response.
I'll keep track of the interruptions.
I'm working
hard to be a gentleman
now.
Here.
Mr. Garcia, 30 seconds
And I am working hard
now.
To follow the rules. This is the same pattern we had.
I appreciate that. Let's go with a response. 30 seconds, sir.
Thank you. My response is this. If we're looking at the company we keep, then under Doug Ducey's administration, up to 7 people he has hired have been under investigation for misconduct. 7.
On the issues, education once again dominated the discussion. Ducey defended his proposal on school safety, which did not gain traction this year in the legislature. Among other provisions, the measure called for more armed school resource officers.
This is a real difference between David and I. He would remove school resource officers. His plan is that actually kids should run for cover. I want to make sure that our schools are safe and that there's law enforcement available.
But Garcia said putting more guns in schools is the wrong approach.
I'm against more weapons on campus. What we need are more eyes and ears, more guidance counselors, more opportunities for our young people to go to. We have one of the highest student to guidance counselors ratio in the country.
The candidates also talked about education funding. Arizona teachers walked out of the classroom this spring to protest low pay, and Ducey touted his plan to increase their salaries without raising taxes.
We were able to get a 20% pay increase advance appropriated to our teachers because our general fund is overflowing with dollars. Our economy is booming right now in the state of Arizona, and the CBO put out a report on April 11th that showed a $1.5 billion surplus in the state of Arizona. And what I wanted to do was communicate to our teachers the commitment that we would make to them going forward.
But Garcia said the issue is about more than just teacher pay.
Educators have made it clear that they are looking to improve public schools. That includes teacher pay raises, but it also includes dollars for the education support professionals that make our schools great places to teach and learn. And that is the reason why they're looking for improvement and for investment in everyone who helps our students.
In addition to education, the other issues addressed by the candidates were water conservation, solar energy, taxes, and the border wall. Last night's debate was sponsored by Arizona Public Media, KJZZ, and the Arizona Daily Star. Our co-host, Steve Goldstein, served as one of the panelists. The general election, of course, is coming up on November 6th.
From the Science Desk, here's KJZZ's Nicholas Gerbis.
A month after Puerto Rico revised its death toll from Hurricane Maria to nearly 3,000, experts are still investigating what made the 2017 North Atlantic hurricane season so active. Now, a new study offers some answers. The 2017 season spawned six major hurricanes, twice the average of 2.7. After 12 years in which no landfalls occurred in the U.S., Hurricanes Harvey, Irma, and Maria drove ashore in the Gulf Coast and Caribbean, causing substantial social and economic damage. Lacking data, many suppose that the events were driven by a moderate La Niña. But a new climate model-based study suggests warm sea surface temperatures, partly driven by human-induced climate change, are to blame. Lead author Hiroyuki Murakami of Princeton University expects the trend to continue.
Our model indicates that hurricane would be continuing to intensify toward the end of the century. It's underway.
The study appears in the journal Science. I'm Nicholas Gerbis in Phoenix.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. From the Business Desk, here's KJZZ's Mark Brody.
The fate of Phoenix's Chinese Cultural Center is still up in the air, roughly a year after a developer announced plans to turn the building into offices. With me to talk about this is Jessica Baim of the Arizona Republic, who's been reporting on and writing about this. And Jessica, why are we basically now still where we were about a year ago?
You know, it has been a very ugly legal battle. There are at least 10 lawsuits going on or that have unfolded at some point over the last year. And really, I mean, we, like you said, we are at the same place we were last year. The main lawsuit, the overarching one, which will probably be the decider of, you know, what happens to the center, is currently in the appeals court. And the appeals process can take so long. And at this point, I mean, it could still be another year before we get a decision on that. So while that is, you know, still being worked out in the legal system, the developer can't make any changes to the roof or the garden at the cultural center. And in the same time, you know, it's kind of limbo for both sides because the community also, you know, at any given moment, the appeals court could make a decision and the center could, you know, be dramatically altered.
Have there been any attempts or even successful attempts between the two sides to talk about this and try to come up with a non-court-based solution?
You know, that was my big question because it seems like the only person winning here are the attorneys for both sides with the amount of court battles that are going on. There have been some discussions. I would say they have not been successful. The developer has, you know, put a lot on the table, really, for a developer to do this. He has offered to maintain the garden, open an interpretive center in the bottom floor. He's offered to pitch in money for a new cultural center. He's offered to transport all of the important items and the tiles from the roof and everything else to a different location. But the community is really holding strong on the fact that they believe that it just should not be altered in any way. And that's kind of the one sticking point. You know, the developer basically said anything's on the table except that.
Why is the community so insistent that this location remain the way it is? I mean, it's not a historic place. It was built in the mid-90s, so it's just, you know, about a little more than two decades old. Why are they not willing to move somewhere else and maybe have a new dedicated Chinese cultural center?
That's a really good question. I think that part of it is just principle. They feel like they've been overrun and that this was the one place that they had. And now, you know, a developer with no ties to the community is coming in and saying no more. I think it's more principle than anything else. But that being said, you know, the center was not doing super well before the developer bought the property. There was a lot of vacancy in the center. A lot of things had closed over the years. That doesn't mean that, you know, their appreciation for the building and its architecture changed, though.
So let's talk about somebody who is associated with the Chinese community here in Arizona, who is sort of serving as a spokesperson for this group, who is no longer serving in that capacity. Who is this guy and sort of what got him disassociated from this organization?
His name is Tom Simon, and he is not Chinese. It's unclear exactly how he became associated with the community. It sounds like he showed up at one of their first protests and was able to bring along with him some political individuals, and the community was impressed by that. The Chinese American community is not typically involved in politics, and so they felt the need to bring in someone that would assist them. This gentleman was definitely interesting in his mannerisms.
Sounds like he was maybe a bit of a provocateur.
Definitely. I mean, at one point he brought bologna to a city council meeting and insisted that bologna was all the community had gotten from the council. So there were a lot of people who were not thrilled by his association. It turns out he had a pretty lengthy criminal history with some different fraudulent schemes, charges, both here in Arizona and in California, had spent a significant amount of time in prison. The community did not know that when they hired him, but they did learn about it and decided to keep him on as a spokesman for almost a year. A couple of months ago, there were a couple of different things that occurred. One, he sent out a pretty rude email about another member of the community, a doctor in the community that's very well respected. The other thing, the final straw, was there was a dispute that led to an arrest with a Chinese American woman. He calls it, you know, a domestic dispute, that they were in a relationship. She insists that that was not the case and that he was basically threatening her job unless she continued to see him. After that situation, the Chinese community decided not to renew his contract.
So you mentioned all the various lawsuits that are out there. Are we just waiting for the court to rule, maybe in that big sort of overarching lawsuit? Is there any hope of any kind of resolution absent what comes out of the court? I mean, so I guess the big question is, where do we go from here?
I think that we're probably going to have to wait for the appeals court. It does not seem like either side will come to a good resolution.
All right, we'll have to wait for the court, it seems, then. That's Jessica Boehm of the Arizona Republic. Jessica, thanks a lot for coming in.
Thank you.
And finally, from the Education Desk.
How do you teach a child about political upheaval, family separation, and perseverance? From KJZZ's Education Desk, Mariana Dale reports from one classroom learning tough history through reading.
A young girl wakes up one day separated from her family by a wall and hatches a dangerous plan to be reunited. That's the plot of young adult novel A Night Divided, set in Cold War Germany.
I just couldn't stop reading.
That's Natalia Quintero, a fifth grader at Queen Creek's Desert Mountain Elementary. Her favorite part of the book is its protagonist, Gerda, who's trapped in East Berlin.
She tried so hard to leave, and she never gave up. That's amazing how hard she tried.
Quintero and her classmates got to meet the author over Skype this week. The excitement was electric. Student Lucy Larson shared her favorite quote from the book, one that actually happened in real life when President John F. Kennedy declared, "I am a Berliner."
I just kind of thought that it meant, like, everyone deserves freedom, even if you were on the west side or the east side of Berlin.
Author Jennifer A. Nielsen says softening the sharp edges of history won't prepare children to be leaders.
If we give kids these stories now, we empower them to change the future later.
Mariana Dale, KJZZ News, Queen Creek.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by Helios Education Foundation, Alliance Bank, the Vitalist Health Foundation, the Intel Corporation, Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian, and this is KJZZ, your news and information station.